Two ambassadors coping with crisis is our subject this morning. This is a subject that sometimes is not included in the curriculum at certain universities, because the assumption sometimes is that it's all in the book. It's in the Quran, or it's in the Bible, or it's in something that one can read, and that experience is not necessary to become an authority on foreign policy. I think that is particularly an illusion when one looks at the contributions that our two speakers have made to the Department of Government and Foreign Affairs at the University of Virginia, because they've both been continually in demand to serve on theses and dissertation committees. They've been called on to lecture from time to time in other people's classes. They've continued a tradition which actually has quite a long span of time at the university. At one time, the international affairs program in the government department was separate from the rest of the government department, but then it was joined. And part of the explanation, I think, is that having had that tradition, people came to see that this was a valuable aspect of the training of young people. But it also reflects the fact that we've been very fortunate, and we're fortunate this morning, that the two people are extraordinary people in the foreign relations field. David Newsom, who will be speaking first, was ambassador in Indonesia, the Philippines, and Libya. He was Undersecretary of State and Assistant Secretary at one time. And for a certain time in the transition between the Carter and the Reagan administration, he was actually acting Secretary of State. He was one of the few people allowed to stay in place while the transition was made, and we're all grateful that he was. Transitions can be hazardous activities. President Eisenhower said, someday some enemy is going to find out that we don't have a government in place in the time between the election and the and January 20th, and for a while it was much later than January 20th, as you know. He's written four major books. We had a panel recently on the imperial mantle, the background of our colonial period, written on democracy and diplomacy, written on a whole series of very fundamental problems. And so has Marshall Bremont, who was ambassador to Iceland, ambassador, assistant deputy ambassador to the United Nations, served as a lecturer at the Moscow Academy of Diplomacy at one time, was also a chairholder at the Center for International Studies at Garmisch, has served in a variety of ways in this capacity. So we're fortunate that somebody will help us answer the question that once we thought was obsolete. We believed that communications and secretaries of state jet bombing into crises could handle it all themselves, and that diplomats on the ground were no longer needed in the way they had. The secretary could do it. Mr. Dulles especially had the reputation of flying in, but so have other secretaries of state. We've learned that was a mistake, and we've learned that, in fact, people on the ground are absolutely essential for the conduct of foreign relations. So it's a great pleasure to introduce our two speakers who have, among other things, helped prove that that was an error. Ambassador Newsom will speak first, and then Ambassador Bremen.
Thank you very much, Ken. I'm impressed that so many should be out to consider a somewhat esoteric subject on a summer day, but I hope that Marshall and I can at least plant some seeds for your further thought. When an international crisis develops and the word comes in to the operations center in the State Department or over CNN, there's at least two aspects that come immediately into play. One is the reporting and actions by diplomats in the field, and the other is the process of making decisions within the somewhat far-flung and complex U.S. government. Marshall is going to talk about the ambassadorial functions in such situations and the importance of day-to-day diplomacy as a precursor to crisis management. And I'll speak primarily from the standpoint of a of an official in the Department of State. When that news does come in whatever form, there are five basic questions which should arise and normally do. First, what happened? Secondly, who needs to be informed of what happened? Thirdly, when and in what forum will decisions be made on the response to the incident? Fourthly, who must be consulted in the process of decision making? And fifth, particularly important in our democracy, what will be said publicly and when? First, what happened? Now, it's not always clear, sometimes not clear for some days, what actually happened when a crisis occurs. I think this was demonstrated in the Chinese aircraft incident when we really didn't know what happened until the crew was actually released. And sometimes crises can be prolonged while experts both in foreign countries and in the United States debate over what happened and who was responsible. Communications may be perfect in people's minds in today's modern world, but they are the bane of the existence of the crisis manager. They are not nearly as perfect as people think they are. And there can be things happen that right in the middle of a crisis, when communications break down, and the people managing the crisis don't really know what's going on. In 1974, our ambassador in the Sudan and our deputy chief of mission were seized by militants at a party in the Saudi Arabian embassy in Khartoum. At the very moment when we were trying in the State Department to determine what was happening and with whom we might speak, a sandstorm blotted out all communications with Khartoum for several hours, and those turned out to be critical hours during which Cleo Knoll and Kurt Moore were killed. The question of what happened also breeds agency competition. Sometimes crises abroad generate their own crises, bureaucratic and political, in Washington. And agencies, intelligence agencies, whether it's CIA or defense or in the Department of State, with their own budgets and prestige in mind, want to be there with the news and the analysis, and sometimes these conflict. And it is not unusual to have a certain bureaucratic competition over what happened. Now, who must be officially informed? Obviously, if something happens, everybody reads about it or hears about it. But Washington is a city of rather large egos, and particularly in the halls of Congress. And members of Congress, particularly the leadership and the chairs of various committees, don't like to read something in the paper. They want to be informed by an official. Why didn't the White House call me? Why didn't the Secretary of State call me? So anyone managing a crisis, knowing that ultimately you're going to have to get back to some of these people in order to resolve the crisis, must be sure that they are informed. Sometimes it's rather disastrous to do this. I wrote a little book on an incident that occurred in 1978 in the Soviet brigade in Cuba, where I felt that I should inform the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Frank Church of Idaho, of a Soviet brigade, presumably in Cuba. Well, it turned out that Senator Church had been blindsided in the Cuban Missile Crisis by not being informed by Senator Kennedy that he was also on the campaign trail in Idaho, and he went public with a denunciation of our efforts to resolve that particular Cuban crisis. But one cannot ignore the necessity to inform the necessary people, both in the Congress and in other executive departments. But then private organizations must also be kept in mind, particularly those that have citizens at risk. When the coup occurred in Libya in 1969, it was essential to inform the oil companies operating there because they had some 6,000 American citizens in Libya at the time. And non-governmental organizations, particularly those working in some African areas, need to be informed. And then one must always have in mind the families of those who may be involved in a crisis abroad. This was particularly true in the Iranian hostage crisis, where we formed a special 24-hour task force to keep in touch with the families, advise them of developments, listen to their questions. Where and by whom will decisions be made and implemented on the response to a crisis? You've all read of the respective roles and sometimes competition between the staff and director of the National Security Council, the Department of State, the Department of Defense. This sometimes immediately comes into play. Who will chair the committee that will attempt to respond to the crisis and resolve the crisis? Usually it's the National Security Advisor, because the president in a major crisis is inevitably involved. But there's some resistance at times to this because there's a tendency for those who manage a crisis to continue to maintain that portfolio even after the crisis is over. And you can have a certain amount of bureaucratic competition as a result. Inevitably, in a crisis, there is the problem of balancing the domestic and foreign considerations. I think this was very apparent as George W. Bush wrestled with the China crisis. Well aware of congressional attitudes on China and on Taipei, he tried to walk, and I think reasonably effectively, walked a tight line between satisfying domestic pressures that wanted a strong and almost bellicose reaction to China and the foreign policy considerations, which required a somewhat softer tone if the problem was to be ultimately resolved through negotiations. Sometimes the White House would just as soon not be involved in a crisis that has domestic implications. And I think it was 1977, Fidel Castro issued an invitation to any Cuban that had relatives in the United States to take a boat and flee to the shores of Florida in the famous Mariel boat lift. Now, the desire of the U.S. government was to stop this flow of Cuban refugees into Florida. And Vice President Mondale invited the leaders of the Cuban community in Florida, of which I'm sure you've all read, to come to the White House, and he was going to talk to them about stopping this flow from Cuba. Well, between the time they left Florida and the time they were to arrive in the White House had further thoughts about getting directly identified with stopping Cubans from coming to Florida. And so the responsibility for meeting with the Cuban community shifted to the State Department. And it's not unusual for something like that to happen. Sometimes departments that are not normally included in academic discussions of crisis situations become center to the resolution of a crisis, particularly the Treasury Department. And in the Asian financial crisis of a few years ago, Secretary Rubin became the prime mover and decision maker. Some in the diplomatic establishment were not terribly happy because they felt that the Treasury was taking a very hard line at a time when a somewhat more nuanced approach, particularly to the Indonesians, would have been desirable. But the Treasury had the ball and the Treasury ran with it. Sometimes it's the special trade representative when issues of trade are paramount to a crisis. Now, who must be consulted? Consultation is a word that is often used as the kind of the answer to most problems, but it's a tricky word in foreign relations. How do you consult? Do you tell people what you're going to do and then wait for them to give their views when you probably have very little intention of following their views, and time may be pressing. Particularly, this has been true with the Allies over the years, who have frequently complained of being presented with fait accompli. And yet it's essential sometimes in a major crisis where problems, particularly such as overflights, may be involved to bring the Allies in. You may remember that when the U.S. bombed Libya, French refused to permit the planes that were taking off from British bases to overfly France, and we were unsuccessful in consulting with the French and turning them around. So the consultations with Allies, consultations with other departments of government, sometimes even with private enterprises, may be necessary, and certainly with the Congress. Will the Congress need to hold hearings on this? Will it be sufficient for the Secretary of State to brief members of Congress? In 1958, when the U.S. sent Marines into Lebanon, the Assistant Secretary for Congressional Relations and I briefed the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in the morning and the House Foreign Affairs Committee in the afternoon on the progress, just to keep the members of Congress aware of what we were doing and perhaps to stem the pressure of some of the more active elements. Who will inform the public and when? as soon as something happens, the media representatives want a statement from somebody. What is the U.S. government going to do about it? Sometimes the U.S. government is not in a position to say what it's going to do about it, maybe for some time. But in our high-pressured government-press relationships, no comment only lasts for about 3 or 4 hours to hold people off. And the government is put in the often difficult position of drafting something which will satisfy the immediate needs of the press, not damage the prospects for a negotiation, not be such as to trigger actions that we do not want, and give the policymakers and the diplomats abroad the time to work this out. One of the most tragic cases of a premature statement. There's some debate about this, but having been in the midst of the crisis, I'm quite convinced that it played a part. Going back to the Sudan crisis of 1974, right in the middle of efforts to negotiate the release of the ambassador and his deputy, just before the sandstorm hit, President Nixon went on the air to say, we will not submit to blackmail in a situation of this kind. We have reason to learn after the fact that that statement convinced those that were holding Ambassador Knoll and Kurt Moore that they were not going to be able to negotiate, and may have, and some of us are convinced that it did have, did contribute to their killing the ambassador. Now, there's a constant danger of leaks in Washington, unofficial information which leaks out, which can also affect the course of a crisis. One of the most famous leaks was in the case of the neutron bomb, when the United States developed a secretly developed a weapon that had the capacity to kill humans but save buildings. And an astute Washington Post reporter, Walter Pincus, picked up a reference to this in a congressional testimony and wrote a piece about the killer weapon. And ever after that, in our negotiations with the Europeans, in our efforts to explain and deal with this weapon system, the crisis managers were up against the designation of this weapon created by that leak. There's always the question of who speaks for an administration. Do you put the president and his prestige on the line? Because once the president has spoken out on an issue, it's almost impossible for him to walk back and designate someone else to be the principal spokespersons on an issue. And yet, if a president doesn't speak out, you have questions about, is he involved? Is he avoiding responsibility? The China incident that we referred to earlier, President Bush took the lead, but you'll notice that the final statements that came out were by the ambassador in Beijing, and I believe the Secretary of State. Sometimes there's a question of how will a decision be revealed? Will there be a presidential speech? Will there be a Secretary of State speech? Will an opportunity be taken in a congressional hearing or a simple departmental statement? And it much depends on the degree to which the U.S. wants to see the decision as positive and having the full backing of the government, or would prefer to let the decision kind of seep out so that the argumentation over the decision is minimized. In a complex U.S. government, ultimately the presidential role is the most important one. It's the president that ultimately must make the decisions, and only the president can make the choice among different assessments and different analyses among his advisors and bring them to a decision. Presidents are not always eager to make that kind of a choice, and so sometimes you will see a crisis clouded by different statements within an administration that are not either contradicted or clarified by the president, because the advice, the pressures of advice are enormous. But perhaps the most famous of all crisis management scenarios, and one in which the president did take and keep command, was the one for which the Miller Center is so closely associated, the Cuban Missile Crisis. And it's worth reading. Thank you.
Thank you. Marshall.
Just as a footnote to what David said, the Cuban Missile Crisis is also interesting in showing what an ambassador can do, because the fact that the Soviet Union had a very trusted ambassador in the United States at the time allowed conversations between Dobrynin and Robert Kennedy to take place, which essentially settled the crisis. That was the key. Those were the key diplomatic interchanges at the time. So some think that ambassadors are endangered species. I would argue that ambassadors still have important functions to fulfill, preparatory to this to appearing here, I just happened to read the Washington Post on Wednesday, and it had a long interview with James Hormel, who was who was designated as ambassador to Luxembourg, but was never confirmed by the Senate because he's an acknowledged homosexual and an activist. He gives a lot of money to various homosexual causes. And it was quite a long piece. And in fact, two full newspaper pages of the Washington Post were devoted to it. And yet I was quite struck by the fact that there was nothing at all in the article which suggested why this man should be an American ambassador anywhere, other than the fact that he was very rich. He had a big meatpacking fortune. And this is interesting to Americans, a group of Americans, because clearly in this country, diplomacy is not seen as a profession, whereas we differ from every other country that I'm aware of in which diplomacy is seen as a profession. And a profession, of course, is a body of knowledge shared by a group of people. And you have boards to test whether a surgeon can really perform an appendectomy, and you have tests to show whether a person can practice at the bar, and there are tests for diplomats that they have to satisfy. For example, the diplomats should be able to speak the language of the country in which they serve, which is not unreasonable. And yet, this administration has just picked an ambassador to go to France, who has no foreign policy experience, no Washington experience, and speaks not a word of French. And if you try to imagine another country sending to Washington an ambassador who doesn't speak English, you put double that in spades and you get the effect in France of having an ambassador who doesn't speak French, because the French, as we all know, they don't think you're either intelligent or cultured a fit person to have discourse with if you do not know anything about France or French culture. So even though diplomacy has been called the second oldest profession in the United States, it is clearly not considered a profession. And this is unfortunate, I think, and we do pay for this, although we're, of course, a great big powerful country, and a great big powerful country doesn't necessarily lose crucially in this, but we have paid. We have paid dearly, and I'm sure David can come up with as many illustrations as I can about how we've suffered from having the wrong person overseas as our ambassador. When you think of an ambassador, it's hard for people to understand what an ambassador really does. I know I had this problem with my children. They say, but what do you do? I think the best way to think of an ambassador is to think of a lobbyist. We can all understand what a lobbyist does. We all understand why Microsoft Corporation pays upwards of $3 or $4 million to their vice per annum to their vice president in charge of governmental affairs in Washington, their Washington lobbyist. They pay that to him because he potentially is acting in a way that can save that corporation billions and billions of dollars. And if you think of the ambassador, basically, as a lobbyist for his country, say the ambassador of the United States is the lobbyist for his country in dealing with all aspects of relations with that country, I think you get a sense of what an ambassador is, what an ambassador can do, and what he really should be doing. Now, what does a lobbyist do, and what does an ambassador do? I would say personally that the most important thing he does is to prevent crises from occurring. David has been talking about what happens when a crisis occurs. A good ambassador stops a crisis from happening, and I can give you some illustrations of that. But this is key. An ambassador has to interpret is another function. He's got to interpret, say the culture and the. David asked the question, "What has happened?" Well, that's what the ambassador has to answer, and I can tell you, although I wasn't in the department, that I'm quite sure that when the China plane went down on Hainan Island, one of the most important aspects of what an ambassador in Beijing is doing is to explain to Washington what happened, and also to outline the way to resolve a particular problem. So he has to be an advocate. He's got to advocate his own or position to the government that he's accredited to, but he also has to explain the situation to his own government. And that's becoming more and more difficult these days when many different forms of information are coming back to the American government, only one of which are the ambassadorial cables in which he's explaining what's happening when a crisis occurs. David mentioned public relations, which has become a very important aspect of what an ambassador does, because he has to be thinking about the public relations of any given problem that he has. Now, what tools does he have to perform that function? A lobbyist's most important tool and an ambassador's most important tool is his Rolodex. The ambassador or a lobbyist should be able to reach anybody in the country to which he's accredited who can resolve a problem that the United States government is interested in. Whatever the problem is, the ambassador should be, and when I say the ambassador, I'm talking about the ambassador and his staff. The people in the embassy. And that's another aspect of this, the Foreign Service or Diplomatic Service aspect, which is a problem in the United States and which is a problem in a country where the top positions in diplomacy are given to often to amateurs. You don't have to be a Foreign Service officer or a diplomat to be a professional in foreign affairs. Because it's obviously if you're going to appoint somebody like Howard Baker who was chief of staff in the White House, head of the majority leader in the Senate. I mean, somebody like that has the kind of background and contacts in Washington that makes him a very valuable ambassador in Japan, where the Japanese are interested in reaching people in the United States and the United States government. But if you appoint people who have no background in foreign affairs, this has a necessarily deleterious effect on the rest of the diplomatic service. If you go into the diplomatic service in France, Germany, Russia, name the country, you know that the top of your profession is being named ambassador, and if you're a fairly able fellow, you assume naturally that you're going to get that job, and you act in a correct way when you think about yourself, because integrity is the single most important attribute an ambassador can have. And you're not going to have integrity if you're a careerist, if you have to worry about how people are going to react if you tell them the truth. You always have to tell them the truth. To find an analogy, if you try and think of one of our armed forces, say the Navy, where all the major positions are given to outsiders, and what kind of an effect this would have on the service as a whole, you get the same kind of an effect that you really do have on the diplomatic service of the United States. So an ambassador has his Rolodex, and an ambassador, just as a lobbyist, he has to know how to cultivate the right people in order to achieve the aims of his government, whatever they happen to be. And to a certain extent, he needs resources in order to do this. The best way to influence people is to break bread with them, to sit down, to talk to them, to become friends with them, and to maintain a friendship with them so that they will listen to you. So that, at the very least, when you get into a crisis, your plane is down in Hainan Island, you know who the person is in the Chinese government to talk to, you explain the situation to him, and he accepts it from you. He understands that you're telling him the situation that you perceive. That is terribly important in resolving any crisis. And I'll just close so that we can have some discussion by giving a couple of examples of, in my own case, I was ambassador to Iceland. And Iceland is a very important country for the United States. It's a NATO ally. But during the Cold War especially, the geographical position of Iceland was terribly important to NATO. And we had on the island a NATO base, which was of paramount importance to us. If you had to name three or four of the most important military bases the United States had at the period, Iceland would be one of them, Keflavik. My aim as ambassador was to try and maintain this. Now we had a government in Iceland at the time in which all Icelandic governments are coalition governments of one of the four major parties, or two or three of the four major parties, and one of the parties in the coalition government at this time were the People's Alliance, which were the party that was the that had succeeded the Communist Party of Iceland. The Communist Party of Iceland had changed its name. It's no longer a Communist Party, but this was the People's Alliance. They were dedicated to getting the United States out of Iceland and out of that base. And therefore, when they were in the government, it became a real problem for the United States and how you deal with the Icelanders. Iceland is a country which makes its living on fishing. 90% of the gross national product of Iceland is determined by fishing. So fishing obviously is a key factor in Iceland. Now, when I was there, what was happening was the International Whaling Convention was about to be voted on. Iceland was a whaling country. They didn't eat the whale meat, they sold it to the Japanese. But Iceland being a very small country with a small population, every Icelander knows every other Icelander in business field, and they were very reluctant to shut down their whaling, which is what the position of the United States was. That is that Iceland should, and they had friends in Norway, the Norwegians, who refused to do this. And the Icelanders were about to go along with the Norwegians. Now, the problem with this was that Icelandic fish exports to the United States were very important, and Greenpeace had as much as told me that if the Icelanders continue whaling, they're going to boycott Icelandic products in American supermarkets and outside Long John Silver chains of restaurants where the Icelanders were selling their fish. And this would have been absolutely catastrophic in terms of American relations with Iceland, and would have impacted, without any question at all, on our ability to carry on our dealings with the base in Iceland. So when the vote was coming up, and it looked like the Icelanders were going to go in a direction that the U.S. government didn't like, nobody in Washington really cared about this too much or had even focused on this. In the Bureau of European Affairs of the State Department at that time, there were 42 countries. Iceland was one of the smallest countries. Nobody was really thinking about this, even though I tried my best to get people excited about it. And my colleague in Washington, the Icelandic ambassador to Washington, was no help in this at all. So I did a quite unusual thing for an ambassador. I started lobbying in a real sense. I called the head of the various fishing associations in Iceland, and I told them, look, if you vote this way on whaling, Iceland's really going to take a hit in terms of trading with the United States. This is not something that's going to be a minor matter. And there are 60 people in the Icelandic Althing, the parliament, oldest parliament in the world, and I called 30 of them. I got on the phone, I explained the situation, I explained, and this really is not a way that an American ambassador should act in Iceland on a usual basis. This would be counterproductive, definitely. But I thought on this one occasion, I did it. I really did everything I could. And indeed, it was very exciting, and we won by one vote. That is, the Icelanders agreed to stop whaling. Now you know it, and the Icelanders know it, but nobody in Washington really knew it or really understood what was happening, because it really didn't matter that much. It was just a question of how it worked. So this is just an example of how a man on the scene can do things for you that you cannot do any other way. You cannot do it by sending out an envoy from Washington. You cannot do it by a telegram. You cannot do it by telephone, although these things are all very important. It's very important when the President of the United States gets on the phone with the Prime Minister of my country or whatever country it is. That's extremely important. But there are other things. He's got to be backed up in his phone calls, and he's got to know what to say when he gets on the phone. And the smaller the country is, the more important the ambassadorial contribution in doing that. And with that, I think I'll stop here, and hopefully we'll get some discussion.
I'd like to begin the discussion. Well, maybe I could begin by asking, what's the best book on diplomacy? I asked three secretaries of state some way back whom I knew, and without exception they said Harold Nicholson's little 100-page book is a classic. Somebody who can write, somebody who, I used to see him when I spent time in London, and he'd come out of the nearest library with a stack of books six this high, and he would come back the next day having read most of them. So exceptional people like that come along and help us understand, but are there other books?
I would say that although I am not, I'm an admirer of Henry Kissinger in many ways, and I'm a non-admirer in other ways, I would say his book on diplomacy is an excellent book and well worth reading. I recommend it.
Yeah. Well, I would agree on Nicholson. There are some other memoirs that give a good view of an ambassador's life. There's one by Charles Thayer called Diplomat, which I think is also a classic, but and there are a few others like that.
Another book I might add, if you're interested in the Soviet Union, where I spent a good part of my career, is Anatoly Dobrynin's memoir on his service in Washington as the Soviet ambassador. It's a very interesting book.
Yes, Bob. Maybe a definitional question as much as anything. I think of a crisis as being a totally unanticipated, somewhat short-term thing, like the Hainan Island thing, maybe even like Cuba, as opposed to, say, the situation in the Northeast or the Middle East between the Palestinian Authority and Israel. And are those approached in a different way from an ambassadorial point?
I would say definitely. I mean, the more important the crisis, the more involved the full range of the government is, and the ambassador becomes one of really a team of people who are dealing with it and making his own contribution to it. But on something like the Arab-Israeli, that's a very good example of a issue that you deal with on a day-to-day basis. And an issue that that your ability to eventually resolve really depends on the preparation you've made to resolve it, it could be your ambassador, or it could, in the Arab-Israeli case, it could be your special envoy, somebody like Dennis Ross, who did this for years and years for the United States, then became. I would say a very exceptionally effective diplomat. I don't know if David would agree with that.
I think you have some perennial issues that are sort of like an endemic illness. They are there constantly, but periodically the temperature rises, and then you have to deal with them as you would deal with another crisis, because often those rises in temperature are unexpected. A sudden suicide bomber, unexpected, the aftermath of that has to be dealt with as one would deal with an ordinary crisis.
You had a question.
Well, I think in the case of Admiral Pruther,
Pruher.
He was a person that had, I think, established his credentials because of his Navy career, and was acceptable to the new administration as an analyst and a representative. I think if you had someone that was seen in political terms as totally out of step with a new administration, it would be more difficult to deal with him in that kind of a transition situation. Whether you agree, Marshall?
Yes, but I think the thing to keep in mind there is that Washington, if it wants to, can completely undercut or go around an ambassador. And Henry Kissinger was a master at this of downgrading the representatives of the president so that he was the number one dealing with whatever it was he was dealing with.
Ambassador Newsom, the Icelandic and the Norwegian travel press have periodically referred to our presence at originally Meeks Field, later Kepdotic, as an occupation. And tell Americans who are visiting there that the presence there is rather frowned upon by Icelanders. What is propelling that?
Marshall?
If I may take that, yes. The most contentious single foreign policy act of the Icelandic government was in 1949 when Iceland voted to join NATO. The vote was roughly three-fifths of the Althing in favor, two-fifths opposed. Iceland is a country that's fiercely proud of its heritage, and that and there are many Icelanders who don't like the idea of a foreign military force on their land. It's something that Americans can certainly understand. We don't have any foreign troops on our land, and when we did have foreign troops in our land, we had a revolution and threw them out. So you do have the, that's one aspect of it. The other aspect is there are many Icelanders who to whom neutrality is a sensible political goal for Iceland. That is, it's a country without armed forces. The United States actually is the armed force of Iceland. And so you do have a very strong current of opinion in Iceland, which had been against the base and against the American presence there. And as I said earlier, since the base was considered so important by the United States, it behooved American ambassadors to keep the thing going, to keep Iceland in NATO and so forth. But having said that, it's always been true that a majority of Icelanders, more than 50%, do favor their ties to NATO and do favor a continuing American presence in Iceland, provided that it's handled with aplomb and finesse. I can tell you, having served 12 years in Southeast Asia, that the real crime of the United States in Vietnam, in my view, was the corruption that the American military brought to South Vietnam and Southeast Asia, including drugs, whorehouses, and what have you, which we're all familiar with. This is unnecessary, in my view, and I can cite the case of Iceland, where in 4 years as ambassador there, I didn't have a single case of military-civilian interaction that was objectionable. One rape would have put the base in jeopardy. Two rapes would have closed that base, and the Navy understood that, and the right policies were followed and have been followed in Iceland, and therefore we've managed to have a very good relationship with that country over many years.
Let's try for three or four more short questions. Victor Yonke and Jack Armitage. Well, that's often a part of any crisis, whether the special interests are some American investment in the country, or in some cases, as Marshall referred to, the Greenpeace, some non-governmental organization that has a cause that is trying to affect the outcome in the response to a crisis. I think that these are just the kinds of problems that the leadership has to deal with and make an effort to explain why the U.S. government is doing what it does. During the crisis created by the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan and our decision to impose sanctions on Afghanistan. I had to call Armand Hammer, who had elaborate plans for a petrochemical plant in Afghanistan, to tell him that those plans had to be scrapped. It wasn't a very friendly call, but it was essential, and he accepted the fact that we had to do what we had to do.
Jack Armitage?
I would call it to your attention to two separate incidents that illustrate the role of the American ambassador and the way it is received over in the White House. When we had the Cuban Missile Crisis, there was the famous Border 13 and so forth. On the board was Tommy Thompson, who was one of the best we had in so far as the Soviet Union was concerned. And President Kennedy turned to him repeatedly to ask him to say what the Soviet reaction would be to whatever moves we took there. This was what an ambassador is all about. This contrasts rather dramatically with the decision made after the Tonkin Gulf affair. The ambassador was on the way back home from Saigon at the time. The decision was all made before he even arrived and determined the set in train, the course of events which involved us in the 500,000 men in Vietnam to no positive effect. I
can
cite that as the receptivity in the White House has changed towards ambassadors in those years and in the years since. And that is one of the major problems of our diplomacy.
You want to comment on that?
Yes, I would say that one of the beauties of the Cold War is that it gave our national effort a focus. And when you have a focus, then your machinery for accomplishing your aims becomes obvious, really. In these days, when there is no where foreign policy tends to be rather diffuse, where we don't have a very clear statement of what our aims are, why we're doing something, then it becomes less important to consult somebody whom you respect, like Tommy Thompson. I think, Jack, that's a very good example of how an ambassador can function if given the chance to do that.
Charlie Smith. Let's go on, Jack. Charlie Smith.
I didn't hear any references to CIA or other intelligence gathering forces that the government has. How important did you find these various intelligence gathering sources to your ambassadorial functions?
Well, there's a lot of has been written about the role of the CIA and its representatives who are under embassy cover in various positions, and the relationships with the ambassador. I never had any problems in that. I think it's important for the ambassador to understand what the mission and the role of the CIA representatives in an embassy may be. And if a mutual confidence can be established, I think there's a good working relationship. One thing that is not always realized is that the CIA personnel in an embassy may not be there primarily to gather information on the country in which they are located. They are there, for example, if it's a country where there may be an accessible Soviet or Chinese mission, to get as much information and maybe even to encourage defections from a foreign embassy in that country. And so if an ambassador understands that and there's enough confidence so that the ambassador can monitor this and point out risks in the relationship with the host country that some of the agency activities might create, that particularly delicate problem can be often but not always handled.
I would say that the CIA poses special problems for the United States in that our intelligence organization combines two separate functions. One is analysis, which is a function that everybody, you have to have. You have to have some kind of analysis of what's going on. The other is covert activity. And covert activity has a mixed history. In some cases, it's been harmful. In some cases, it's been beneficial. It's pretty much a wash. When we were in a Cold War, I think we had to have that kind of capability. Now that we're outside a Cold War, my own view is that we have to look at the covert activities much more carefully than we have before, because the benefit we get from these covert activities becomes much less clear than they would have been otherwise. But the one function that you have in an embassy that CIA people have traditionally done is liaison with local security people. And this is something that has to be done, and if you didn't have a CIA, you'd have somebody else that did it. The FBI is becoming much, much more active abroad than it had been previously, and I think this is something that really that our citizenry and our Congress should watch very carefully. That's my view.
I hope if you have questions, you come up and ask them. One of the things that comes through is the race against time. Former Secretary of State, who also had a long foreign policy experience, said the most difficult thing was being called at 3 a.m. and asked, what is the policy about of the United States on a crisis that had just occurred? And I'd like to remind you that we face a somewhat similar crisis right now. And the crisis is a race against time to match a very substantial foundation grant that we have. And we don't expect any one of you or all of you put together can make that match. What we do expect is that some of you could do a little more maybe than you have in suggesting others who have the means and the resources to help in this situation. That's where we need help, and that's where you're in a position to help us, I think, as we face a deadline on this match. And the thing that is lost if we don't make the match is the kind of education we've had this morning, and really two people with almost lifetime experiences telling us about what they learned. So we thank you very much.
Thank you.